Please be seated. The next matter on calendar is case number 55303, In Re Abood Inter Vivos Trust. You'll note that Justice Seda is not here. She's unavoidably elsewhere. She will listen to the tapes of today's argument and participate in deliberating and deciding it. So you do have a three-judge panel. It's just two of us are here today. Ms. Pagni for the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Tiffany Pagni on behalf of Appellants ICANN Foods Corporation, the estate of Betty Jo Abood and David Abood. I'm here today with my colleague, Doug Brown, who also represents appellants David Abood, Ashley Ferguson, Maureen Mazel, and other family members. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
This appeal questions the jurisdiction of a district court to enter a judgment against non-parties and binding on non-trust property in a trust proceeding. For the court's consideration, we've raised multiple challenges to the judgment in this case, the first of which is that the law in Nevada is clear that you cannot bind a corporation when corporate property is at stake and is at issue in a controversy, yet the corporation is not made a party to that claim. That's what happened to ICANN Foods in this trust proceeding. ICANN Foods was an indispensable party, and they needed to be joined pursuant to Rule 19A. Now, the same theory would theoretically apply to the partnership. Partnership assets were also ultimately at issue in this case. They weren't at issue in the beginning. They became an issue, and the partnership was not made a party to these proceedings. Yet the judgment in this case interferes with a contract between the partnership and the corporation regarding the sale of partnership assets. The judgment in this case also is against now the estate of Betty Jo Abood. She's died since these proceedings began. But it's not clear what exactly on what basis the judgment was rendered against her and in which capacity it was rendered against her. You may recall, and it's clear in the briefing and disputed in the record, that she was a trustee. She was the trustor, first of all. Then she was a trustee. And then she was also a general partner of the partnership. There were never any pleadings where allegations were made directly against Betty Jo Abood in any capacity. There were never any pleadings where ICANN Foods was, where any specific relief was asserted against ICANN Foods. Because of that, their due process rights were violated. They weren't given the opportunity which the Constitution and the rules of our civil procedure allow them, which is also to appear, to defend those interests, to assert the appropriate defenses, which in this case would have included a motion to dismiss because Ms. Shepherd did not have standing to seek the relief that I think she wanted when she instituted this proceeding through the petition for an accounting. Once the accounting was provided to her, the district court's jurisdiction at that point in terms of what she had, the relief she had requested, as well as removal of the successor trustee and appointment of a new trustee, it was done. What the district court had to do at that point was done. If the trustee believed that there were any issues, that there were any problems that he found after he did his investigation, what they should have done was file an independent action. Chapter 164 provides no means by which to bring in a third party who has no interest in trust proceedings and to plead claims against that party. There has been an issue raised in the answering brief that these parties appeared. They participated. Why aren't they parties? Well, as you know, Chapter 164 requires notice to beneficiaries and to interested parties. Betty Jo Abood, David Abood, well, Miss Ashley Ferguson now, it was Ashley Hickey at the time. She was a successor trustee. She was the true respondent. But those folks were given notice because they were interested parties, because they were beneficiaries, because they were the trustor. They weren't put on notice at that time that there were claims being made directly against them, that a monetary judgment could be entered against them individually. And that's where the due process problem comes in. They had a right to participate as real parties in interest. They were witnesses. They did what the court asked them to do to help put the information before the court that he thought was missing for in this accounting proceeding. They could do that without subjecting themselves to a judgment. With regard to the judgment again, there's also been, let me go back. If this court believes that it was appropriate to hear those claims, which I think even the district court recognized, if you look at the transcript of April 2009, and I will refer you to the Joint Appendix, Volume 5, page 955, even the court says when Mr. Clark is asking for specific relief, which has been objected to by Ashley Ferguson, because she's saying, all they asked me for was an accounting. I wasn't involved in this. You've got the wrong parties here. If you look at the appendix and through the record, it's repeated throughout the record. The court even says, the question is, who's responsible for that, and are they properly before this court? Later, the court asks Mr. Clark when he's asking for there to be an award, in April 2009, by the way, when Mr. Clark's asking for there to be an award against ICANN Foods, the court says, are there any pleadings that puts anyone on notice with regard to the money damage award? Mr. Clark says, there's a combination. The first is the initial trustee's report. Well, a trustee's report is not a pleading as defined by the law. Mr. Clark knows that. These other parties weren't represented by counsel at this point. The court knew that. The district court knew that. At this point, what should have happened is the district court should have said, I do not have jurisdiction in this proceeding to afford you the relief you are requesting. He didn't do that. He proceeded. And why he entered judgment after those objections have been made is unclear from the record, because the judgment is not supported by any of the evidence in the record. Gone through that in the opening brief, the primary erroneous factual statement in the judgment is that the sale of partnership property somehow was trust property. And the reason that's a problem is because Ms. Shepherd herself knew in 1999, well before all of this happened, she, by consent, transferred with the other beneficiaries of that residual trust all of the real properties into a partnership. She did it upon the advice of counsel with her husband and her mother as the general partners of the partnership and as the trustees of that residual trust.
So that left the residual trust as holding a personal property interest in the partnership only. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor. That is the only asset of the residual trust, which is what happened is it got convoluted in the district court because Mr. Clark and Ms. Shepherd kept referring to trust property. These real pieces of property are trust property. They weren't. All the trust had was that personal property interest. Take the relationships of the family aside. If the residual trust and the beneficiaries of that trust had transferred all of their property into a partnership to invest, someone that wasn't related, we wouldn't be having this problem we're having.
Ms. Pagne, this case raises the question of the reach of NRS 164.0101 and 015. As you know, those statutes permit a district court to entertain a petition in which the administration of a non-testamentary trust is raised.
Correct.
My understanding of the original petition of this case was to remove the existing trustee and to seek an accounting.
That's correct in part, Your Honor. The first was a petition for an accounting. And then once those accountings were provided, and I've reviewed them, and they look like they were provided in compliance with the law to me, I was involved, then there was a subsequent petition to remove the trustee.
And in the subsequent petition, was there any other relief requested other than the removal of the trustee?
The removal of the trustee and to appoint Michael Shepherd as the new trustee. That was the relief requested.
What this case raises, I think, is what does the district court's, you wouldn't dispute that the district court has in rem jurisdiction over trust assets.
That's correct, I would not
And
that.
Has authority to order an accounting.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The question then is, what is the continuing authority of the district court when the accounting results are provided, particularly, at least by implication in this case, when the accounting results suggest defalcations on the part of trustees or prior trustees?
At that point, Your Honor, I think those claims need to be clearly pled and those proper parties brought before the court.
The problem, Ms. Pagne, is where in the statute is that required? It appears as though the district court proceeded on the basis that I've ordered the accountings and I have the authority to order the accountings. The accountings show certain defalcations, and I'm going to proceed to grant monetary relief as a consequence. Are you suggesting that the statutes are silent with respect to what the district court judge does when the trustees or when the accountings are provided and there are problems with them?
No, I'm not, Your Honor. Chapter 164 does provide a means to remedy issues if a breach of trust is found. The problem in this case is that there was no breach of trust found against the party against whom the petition was originally filed. Mm-hmm. If in fact they found that there was a problem with what the prior trustee did, the petition should have been amended. And it's not in that statute, that's not clear, but that's what due process requires, Your Honor.
So your argument would be that even though this is an in rem proceeding, which governs the race of the trust, or the claimed race of the trust, persons who have an interest must be brought into the action.
If direct claims are being made against them, well, actually, anybody who has an interest in the property that's at dispute needs to be brought in.
My understanding, I just wanted to be sure I have this right, and both counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, Betty and Michael Abood formed this trust on the death of the first spouse. A survivor and a residual trust were created, and that subsequent to the time that those trusts were created, both the survivor trust and the residual trust conveyed whatever assets were contained within the trust to the family limited partnership. Is that right?
That's correct. They invested in the partnership.
Okay. And then the family limited partnership at some point sold or transferred the assets that it had to Icon Foods, Inc.
That's correct.
Or LLC. Is it Inc. or LLC?
Inc.
Okay. Is there any contention by your clients that there were assets in either Icon Foods, Inc. or the partnership that did not come originally from the conveyance from the trust?
No, Your Honor, the real property, the assets of the partnership were originally trust properties. They were put in the partnership, and then those partnership assets were 5 years later sold to a corporation.
So if one traced these assets, they went from the trust to the partnership to Icon Foods, and the dispute here did not involve assets that Icon Foods or the partnership had obtained from some other source.
Your Honor, I would disagree with that, because when a third party acquires legal title to trust property in the manner that it happened here, the third party takes that free of equitable interests of beneficiaries. The trust and the beneficiaries of the trust consented to investing in a partnership. Again, if you take the family out of it, they invested that property. They have the risks of that property. They signed a contract that told them how it was going to be managed and operated, that property, what they were going to get from it, if there was a problem, how they could dispute it. So when the district court was looking at the trust property and looking at whether or not there was some malfeasance or however you want to put it, they were looking...
That's a different issue. You're suggesting that under the contracts, the arbitration provisions should have been considered.
I'm saying, Your Honor, that the district court cannot go as far as it did. Once that was no longer, those properties were not trust property at the time the proceeding was instituted.
I'm just trying to determine whether there is any claim in the case that the assets originally conveyed from the trust to the partnership and from the partnership to Icon Foods, Inc. Differed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, they do differ just in one respect. That's the business of the griddle. The business of the griddle was not the real property upon which that restaurant sits was trust property, but the actual going concern of that business was not.
So the griddle restaurant was created after the partnership acquired the assets or after the ICANN Foods acquired the assets?
No, the business of the griddle had been ongoing for years and years and years.
Okay. So it was never a trust asset?
It was never a trust asset.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, Douglas Clark, on behalf of Michelle Ray Abood Shepherd, who is present in court today. She is a beneficiary under her parents' trust. We'll start with the last question the court had first about the griddle restaurant. The statement was made that the griddle was never part of the trust. The trust has an explicit provision regarding the griddle restaurant. It said in the Second Amendment to the trust, which is part of the record, that the Michael Abood share, community share of the trust, was going to go to three beneficiaries, three of the brothers and sisters, with the exception of David Abood. Now, of course, David Abood has ended up with the restaurant. The restaurant was part of the trust. The trustee, the successor trustee, Barry Solomon, who was appointed, could find no record of any consideration whatsoever having been paid for the restaurant.
Why was it not incumbent on the successor trustee to initiate an independent action of whatever nature to reclaim that, if indeed those statements are true, where the defendant would have been summoned into court and held to account for a claim against the defendant asserting individual damages or reconveyance? That's the problem in the case.
Your Honor, actually it's not a problem. The proceeding is a statutory proceeding under 164.015, and the express language of the statute incorporates other statutes. And let me tell you what it does. It says that in Section 1, proceedings which may be maintained under this section are those concerning the administration and distribution of trust, the declaration of rights, and the determination of other matters involving trustees and beneficiaries of trust, including petitions with respect to a non-testamentary trust for any appropriate relief provided with respect to a testamentary trust in NRS 153.031. So 164.015 refers to another statute. 153.031 provides additional relief by statute in Section 1F, settling the accounts and reviewing the acts of the trustee, including the exercise of discretionary powers. Section M, compelling redress of a breach of trust. And Q, compelling compliance with the terms of the trust or other applicable law. Those are the sections that give the district court the statutory authority to follow through with the remedies to make the trust whole and to make the beneficiaries whole in the event that the petition yields evidence of wrongdoing. Now, there are a number of things that happened here, but let me address them in the order that counsel addressed them and the court addressed them. There were seven properties, six real properties in Winnemucca and one real property in Mountain View, California.
Well, counsel, let me ask you something before you get into your discussion of this case.
Yes.
Are you suggesting that the court interpret the statutes in the manner in which you've described so as to permit a judgment, a monetary judgment, to be entered by the district court against someone who was never made a party to the trust proceedings? And let me give you this hypothetical. The trust, a beneficiary brings a petition in a non-testamentary case, asks for administration and instructions, removal of the trustee, and an accounting. The court appoints someone to do the accounting. The accounting produces a result that shows that funds have been diverted to a third party, can the court then enter judgment for the amount of the diverted funds against the third party who's never been noticed or participated in the proceeding?
Under your hypothetical, probably not.
So you wouldn't be advocating that these statutes be read to allow the district court to reach out and enter a monetary judgment against someone who has not been made a party to the proceeding?
No, your hypothetical had one other thing, that had not participated in the proceeding. In probate cases, in trust cases...
May I ask you to pause there just a moment, and okay. it's germane to Justice Hardesty's question. If, holding with his hypothetical, the third party is a stranger to the proceeding, at that point, would it not be incumbent on the successor trustee to commence an independent action against the third party to recover the squandered or improperly transferred funds?
No. That's not the practice of the courts in this area.
So how does the third party get to come and say, you know, this is the allegation, but this is my property. I gave good value for it, and I do not deserve to have a judgment entered against me.
They're given notice and opportunity to appear. There are two ways to get into a probate or trust proceeding. It's a proceeding in rem under the statute 164.015. If you're an interested party and you're given statutory notice, you are bound in rem by the decision of the court whether you show up or not. If you are not given notice, but you show up and appear on the record and defend your interests, then you are a party, and you are bound by the court's decision. That's how it happens in probate court, and that's how it happens in trust proceedings.
Even as to recovery of assets that have been removed from the trust or the estate, properly or improperly, you're saying the in rem jurisdiction allows the court to enlarge, in effect, the property before the court by claiming back property that allegedly was improperly diverted.
The statutory scheme does not abandon the law of trusts. And the law of trusts is most frequently set forth in restatement second of trusts or restatement third of trusts. The statutory scheme does not involve abandonment of that. In the situation where someone has received a trust asset, either gratuitously or in some way in breach of the trust, then the trustee can go after it and brings that party into court and provides them notice that they're going after the asset. In this case, that's exactly what happened.
Well, not exactly, because the trust asset was the interest in the partnership. And the conveyance was from the partnership to the third party. So the trustee was pursuing not just the interest in the partnership, but a claim that would have been asserted through the partnership to the third party. As I understand it, if I'm wrong
correct.
On that.
Well, actually, you may be a little bit incorrect, and let me tell you what happened. There was no dispute about transferring the trust assets to the limited partnership in 2000. All parties were on board.
And there was an exchange, a personal interest in the partnership in exchange for the real property.
Exactly right. Now, when we filed this action in 2006, we were unaware that a secret transaction had taken place in 2005 that transferred all of the partnership interests, general partner, limited partnership, and every interest to ICANN Foods. Now, the transfer was done by Betty Jo Abood in two capacities, one as general partner and the other one as the successor trustee of both the survivor's trust and the decedent's trust. Under the restatement, the successor trustee, has the right to go back after those assets because they were transferred to a party with knowledge.
I don't think that there's much question that the statutory construct would allow the court to examine and trace assets. The question that I think this case raises, Mr. Clark, is, and the reason I posed the hypothetical I did was for a specific reason. What is the level of notice required to the third party in my hypothetical to bring them within the scope of the in rem jurisdiction of the court? Since we tend to ask you lots of questions at once around
That's
here, we
fine.
Probably shouldn't do that. But and the second question is, assuming that no notice is given, but the party decides to participate by filing some pleadings, then what is the level of participation that subjects them to the jurisdiction of the court, even when notice wasn't given?
When they participate on the issues that seek to provide some sort of liability to them, when they seek an adjudication, when they participate in the adjudication of those issues, then they're bound. And let me point out two defining moments in this case when that happened. The first one was as to Ashley Hickey, David Abood, and Betty Jo Abood. There were points and authorities that were filed by my office to the district court in support of the order pursuant to the successor trustee's initial report. That's Joint Appendix 24. And it specifies exactly the relief that is requested against each one of those parties. With respect to ICANN Foods, and of course an order was entered after that, that provided for relief against those parties. The second one, defining moment, is as to ICANN Foods. There was a district court hearing on January 12, 2009. The defining moment was the entry of the order regarding the successor trustee's initial report, and it directly bound both David Abood and ICANN Foods. Now, ICANN Foods doesn't exist apart from David Abood, and there's two reasons why that's true. First of all, this transaction was structured to provide a distribution of $237,000 to David Abood as part of his inheritance. It didn't go to David Abood. It went to ICANN Foods as part of the 2005 sale. That wasn't a distribution to David Abood. There was no intervening steps.
But the sale was by the partnership to ICANN Foods.
By ICANN Foods.
But it was by the partnership, correct?
Right. But the partnership, see, was acting under the supervision of Betty Jo Abood, who also had her trustee's hat on. So she had fiduciary duties running both to the partnership and to the trust and breached both of them. What happened
what do you
with
make
ICANN
of,
Foods?
But if you could return to my question, Mr. Clark, what was it that subjected ICANN Foods to the jurisdiction of the court? What did they do? They didn't get a notice. There wasn't any notice under... notice of trust proceedings.
They were there.
What did they do?
They were there, and an order was entered against them, and they complied with the order. And they continued thereafter. Now, something kind of funny happened after that. ICANN Foods began to be represented by Ashley Hickey, appearing in pro per as the trustee, but arguing on behalf of ICANN Foods, and arguing on behalf of Betty Jo Abood, and arguing on behalf of David Abood.
Which takes us to counsel's argument in this appeal. As you know, we do not permit corporations to be represented either pro per or by non-lawyers. And in fact, corporations are not allowed to enter appearances on their own. So what is your response to counsel's point that, given those rules, ICANN Foods never participated, quote-unquote, in this proceeding?
The order was entered against ICANN Foods.
Well, I understand that, but
okay,
before the order could be entered, they had to have appeared in the action, participated in the action legally.
So does ICANN Foods have any obligation once an order is entered against it?
Not if it hasn't participated is the question.
It is participating. The pleadings are full of allegations and defenses of ICANN Foods. It's de facto participating in these proceedings. It's present. An order is entered against it. Should it not appeal under there's an appeal provision under 164.015. There's NRAP 3A. Shouldn't an appeal be filed at that point in time, or a motion to vacate the judgment, a special appearance to do it? Something has to be done. There's an order entered, and ICANN Foods is before the court. That's the rub in this case.
There were no, were there any notices initiated by the court or by your clients to ICANN Foods, the partnership, or the predecessor trustees of no, these proceedings?
Nothing issued directly, no.
So the argument you make is that their participation in these proceedings subjected them to the court's jurisdiction and powers under the statutes you've enumerated?
Two things, their participation and their possession of the trust assets. Remember, there are no assets that ICANN Foods holds that were not assets of the trust. Mm-hmm. The trust has no assets other than what is now possessed by ICANN Foods.
Well, the trust has the interest in the partnership, which in turn may have a claim against ICANN Foods. But I'm having trouble making it directly go through to ICANN Foods, who never appeared.
Well,
I'm struggling with that. And I'll give you an extra minute, 30 seconds
Eddie
to
Joe
answer
Abood
that.
Was present before the court in both capacities. By her pleadings, she was present in both capacities. By her participation in the 2005 secret transaction, she was present in both capacities. Because of her participation in this transaction, which left the trust with no assets, she was not going to go after ICANN Foods. They're both represented and both argued for, both then by pro per counsel and now by the same counsel. I don't think the statutory scheme under 165 and 153 requires an independent action. And a trust proceeding does not require a joinder of parties under Rule 19. I haven't seen that. I haven't seen a joinder of parties. It's by appearance and by being statutorily noticed.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Pania, I gave your opponent an extra minute and 30 seconds, so could you add the same to hers?
Just a couple points of clarification, Your Honor. When we talked about partnership property in the addendum to the opening brief, I would refer you to Schedule B, which shows the partnership property and lists the six real properties, and the Griddle business as an ongoing concern is not listed. It's also not listed in the tax return when the trusts were split in 1998. I couldn't find that for you in the record. I'd be happy to provide that site to you after I have a chance to go through that. There's no bloodline exception to due process, period. In Chapter 164, just because it's a trust proceeding doesn't mean that it puts anyone who appears and participates on notice that they can be subject to a monetary judgment, in this case of over $700,000. That cannot happen pursuant to the law, pursuant to the Constitution. The argument that Mr. Clark says ICANN Foods was there. They were there. There was an order against them. They were never there. As we've pointed out, a corporation has to be represented by counsel. They were never put on notice. David Abood was there. Well, David Abood was an interested party. He was a beneficiary to this trust. He had every right to be there. They were doing what the court was asking them to do. They were trying to provide the information. They were giving the court information. They were never noticed that they could be subject to a monetary judgment. And, in fact, ICANN Foods never received any notice of anything until 2010. After I got involved in this case and I told Mr. Clark, I think it was in our motion to alter or amend and to declare the judgment void, I pointed out that ICANN Foods had never been served with
counsel,
the judgment.
My understanding of the court's order is that it's twofold. It did enter a monetary judgment of almost $800,000, I think was the figure, or something like that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the judge also entered a constructive trust order.
That's correct.
On assets that the judge perceived to follow a tracing from the trust. Should this court reverse the constructive trust order of the judge?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Why would we do that when it appears that the district court has jurisdiction under the statutes to follow the tracing suggested by the accountings, at least with respect to the real property, and place a constructive trust on those assets?
Your Honor, again, any interest these beneficiaries had in that real property, they transferred to a partner. They invested in a partnership. Now that investment is controlled by a partnership agreement. The partnership then sells assets to a corporation, has authority to do so under the partnership.
But the judge seems to have said this was improper, and I'm going to set this aside, these transfers, and at least impose a constructive trust on the assets so the assets don't make further trips along the road until we sort this out. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that, Your Honor, is because it was based on a basic misconception and misinterpretation of the law and what was a trust asset at the time that constructive trust was entered. The judge did not have authority to do what he did. Those were not trust assets. Ms. Shepherd can now go and claw back what she has already given up through a trust accounting proceeding, which is what she was trying to do here. How do we protect? I mean, this is a slippery slope. How do we protect? And again, you have to take the family relationships out of this. A third party buys assets that belong to a general partnership. They use attorneys in this transaction. Everything's on board. And then 2 years or a year, actually 2009, 4 years after you've been paying on promissory notes, after you've been doing what you're supposed to do pursuant to that contract, a district court can now come in and say, well, those properties once belonged to this person. Now, there may have been a problem between the transfer of these properties way back when. So you know what? We're gonna go ahead and put a hold on those. You can't do anything with your property. And to do it without notice. Those are two reasons the constructive trust should be lifted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel, for your briefs and arguments. They were excellent, and this is a challenging case. This case will stand submitted.